You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This week I'm talking to Cynthia Katohata, whose new book, The Floating World, has been published by Viking, and I'll be talking in the second half of the program to Brian Kightley, whose first novel, Still Life with Insects, has been published by Tickner and Fields. Cynthia is here in town visiting her family. Her novel, The Floating World, is a soft, spiky, funny book about someone whose coming of age takes her floating through the Pacific Northwest down to Arkansas and along our coast. Los Angeles is visited for a while. It's a novel that might be said to be about the experience of someone growing up in America who is also growing up as an Asian American. When you started to write The Floating World, what was your goal?
Just to get published, I guess, was my first goal. But I definitely wanted, I'd always thought that the first thing I write, I wanted to be about Asians, because just sort of as somehow redeeming my parents' lives or something. So I guess that was mainly what I wanted to do something for my parents.
Are they proud of the book?
My mother actually hasn't read it, but she doesn't like fiction, so that's why she hasn't read it.
Oh, even by her daughter?
Yes, even by her daughter, maybe especially by her daughter. But my dad has read it twice, and he's very proud of it.
The novels that you read growing up that made you perhaps say, I would like to write like that, or this book makes me want to be an author, what might those be?
When I was growing up, really, I read almost all science fiction. I read a lot of science fiction, and I read, you know, more fantasy books, kind of. I guess the books that really made me sure I wanted to be a writer were James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, and maybe Joan Didion's essay books, her first two collections. So I guess two nonfiction books, and I didn't really want to write fiction when I was younger. I thought it was sort of a lower form of writing or something. It wasn't truth or, you know.
What marked the change?
I don't know. In 1981, I moved to Boston, and I just started reading fiction for the first. I had never read contemporary fiction at all before. I mean, never. And I just said, "Wow, this is great!" And I just started writing.
What were the books then that made you excited?
Well, the first contemporary fiction I can remember reading is Anne Beattie's short story collections, and I just said, wow, and it was like she was talking to me or something.
Yeah, there are those, me too, I count Anne as a friend and a close friend. There are those who, you know, discovered their own contemporary world in her stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, like Anne Beattie, you've begun your career in The New Yorker. That must have been a very satisfying turn of events.
It was fun. One of the things my editor told me when I first sold my story was that almost everybody, when the story gets published, they feel actually depressed. And so after it was published, it was kind of a letdown. I mean, I think you expect it to be some earth-shattering, you know, everything moving in slow motion and music, but it wasn't really like that. So
the novel, The Floating World, takes the heroine, a 12-year-old girl named Olivia Fujitano?
No, Osaka is actually her name.
Uh-huh. Fujitano was
the grandmother's name.
Uh-huh. From the age of 12 to approximately the age of 20, it's kind of an odd thing. People keep calling this narrator wise beyond her years, but she didn't exactly strike me that way. How do you characterize her? What kind of a adolescent is she?
I don't consider her so wise. I mean, I think she's just, in a lot of ways, a little girl, but maybe because the author at the time she's writing it, or, you know, Olivia at the time she's writing it, is older, that is maybe interspersed with her youngness, so people think that's the young narrator speaking or something. I'm not really sure. I thought she was, you know, I thought she was high-spirited, I hope, like her grandmother, without the meanness. But no, I don't think she was wise, really.
Her grandmother is a famous pincher. and in fact is known to her mother. You should have seen her in her real pinching heyday, or something like that, the mother says. Is there a way, I guess, in which grandmothers enforce their lessons by pinching them into the flesh of their grandchildren?
This was a story someone had told, a relative had told me about another relative, but no, I don't know if it's... actually, a couple of people have told me after I did this that they had relatives who pinched them, but I personally have never been pinched.
It was sort of funny because when I was growing up, my grandmother had a Russian singing song that you would sing with your first and second finger, your thumb and your first finger, pinching the flesh on the back of the other person's hand, all four hands, while you sang these Russian nonsense words, which to this day are mysterious to me, but I think two of them were Tsorichka Warichka. Olivia floats through the world, and my impression of her narrative voice is that she's puzzled and startled by many things, and that her attempts to describe things are muted by kind of excitement and to some extent misunderstanding. That there's a kind of beautiful quality as you read the book. The book floats away behind you like scenery passing by a car. And because it is a book about the floating world, a world of people driving through America, staying at motels and truck stops, it's a book that, less than other books, has no beginning, middle, and end. It's a floating book. Mm-hmm. Was it hard to know how to shape such a narrative?
Yeah, it was really hard. What happened is a friend of mine read the book for me, and he sort of helped to give it shape, because at the time, it was just sort of this big arbitrary mishmash of things, and he kind of suggested things, but otherwise it was very hard, yeah. I didn't really conceive of it as a novel. I think I more was conceiving of it originally as short stories or connected short stories, so in a way, I think if I had it to do over again, I might do it as short stories, but I'm not really sure.
What would be the difference? Would there be a tonal difference if they were divided into short stories?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the difference would be. Maybe each one would have more, each chapter would have more of a sense of a beginning and an end, rather than trying to lead one into the next. I guess I don't know if I'm really a novelist or a short story writer. I'm just a writer, but I'd always before that written short stories. I'd written a lot of stories, but I'd never to me it's more connected short stories, I guess. I hate to say that, but I think it's true.
We were talking a bit before about writing programs, and you mentioned to me something that I suspect is often true, that they may be not entirely, but a little bit of a scam. Could you...
I actually wrote a letter to the head of the writing program at Columbia once and told him I thought the program was a scam, and he got really upset. But I guess I just feel like they're really, really expensive, and they don't really... I mean, if you want to pay the money to make connections, then I think you can do that. I do think that a lot of people at Columbia met people who are going to help them or who have already helped them, but they're not really... Columbia, I didn't feel, was really oriented towards making people's writing better. It was oriented toward, you know, meeting people and trying to get published, and everybody was interested in getting published, and nobody was interested in being a better writer. Well, some people were, but... Yeah.
Do you think that might be inevitable at a school that's in New York at the center of the publishing world, that there might be more concentration on making, you know, acquaintances work than on improving the craft?
I don't know. I hope it's not inevitable, because that means it's going to go on and on. But it's true, I did go to a program, which I also dropped out of, in Pittsburgh, and it was much less oriented towards publishing. It was just people interested in their writing. So maybe it does have to do with New York. Or also, New York is kind of a hustler's town in a lot of ways, so that just sort of...
You're talking in
everyone.
The city of, of hustlers. I'm curious, you know, you thank in your opening notes the dark and mysterious man of American fiction agenting, Andrew Wiley, who said in favorable ways and in certain dark ways to have altered the way in which a novel gets accepted and published and paid for. Can you say anything about him?
I actually don't know him that well. I talk more to one of his assistants, Deborah, than to him, but he's really nice to me. I have no idea how he acts to other people, but he's very nice. He's very professional. He's very, very smart. I mean, you certainly get the sense talking to him that you're talking to a very intelligent man. He's a character. He's definitely a character. I really don't know him that well. It's funny. I don't know if... I think, actually, he probably has to behave better than most people because of his reputation. So I think he probably behaves really, really, really well with his authors.
Well, given the people that he represents, Rushdie and Chatwin and many interesting...
Now Philip Roth.
American young writers, I'm inclined to like him, but I do every so often hear these sort of intensely thuggish description.
Well, he also has a lot of non-mainstream and non-white writers. I mean, it seems like more than any other agent has a client list that's representative ethnically, if nothing, you know, of America at large. So I like that about him. It makes me feel comfortable with him.
Some of the reviewers have talked about The Floating World, which has just been published by Viking, as being one that is about the Asian American experience, but without overtly referring to it. So that when I was reading the book, I went carefully through and said, no, I don't get the point. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, fully about a Japanese family. But there has been some criticism voiced about that as well. How do you feel about that?
I actually did this interview in Seattle where the guy was sort of attacking me. And he was kind of calling me socially irresponsible and saying, well, some people think this could just as well be about white people. And I said, well, you know, I just wrote a book. And I don't feel that it's my duty to be socially responsible to a group of people. I mean, that isn't what I do as a writer. I want to be socially responsible, but if I'm not, then, you know, I'm not. And I guess I got really mad because I felt that it's sort of pigeonholing me. It's kind of like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because if you write this book that's overtly Asian, then everybody has sort of pegged you now as this writer who's always going to write about Asians. And then if you don't, everybody's like, well, she's not really Asian. And, I mean, I don't like people telling me how to, quote, be Asian.
Mm-hmm. In the course of the book, a shrine is built to the dead grandmother, a shrine that goes on to encompass ads for Coca-Cola and photographs from Life magazine. Is this book in some sense a shrine to the grandmother and to the spirits and superstitions that she invokes in the book? It's a book full of ghosts and tricks and pranksters.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just because I personally sort of... it's not that I actually believe... I'm very superstitious, so to me, for instance, when the grandmother dies, I didn't really think of that as her actually dying. I thought she was still alive. I mean, she was dead literally, but not really. And so I guess in a way, yeah, I think it's true. It is sort of a tribute to that.
There's a beautiful scene in the car where you're the parents of Olivia's parents and her brothers start to behave briefly like the now dead grandmother. The mother smokes a cigar and someone says, too much magic on the road, which is something that the grandmother had said throughout. I did like that sense of characteristics, as the mother says, dispersing and floating through the other characters. It kind of gives both a beautiful sense of the discontinuity of the people in the book and the continuities that they carry on willy-nilly. I guess the book is a book of transiencies and permanences. That's what I took away from it. Is that something that you considered?
Yeah, I think it's sort of both. I mean, they move a lot, but they're very, very stable in the way they interact with each other. So in that respect, it's not, you know, their lives aren't that transient. But it was also, I guess, sort of melancholy, because when you move a lot, I think you sort of develop that melancholy. So, yeah, it was sort of both. It was sort of about both.
I've been talking to Cynthia Katohata, whose novel, The Floating World, has just been published by Viking Press. I want to thank you for having been here with me, Cynthia. And we'll be talking to Brian Keitley after this brief musical interlude. Our second guest on Bookworm today will be another first novelist, Brian Keitley, whose book Still Life with Insects is published by Tickner and Fields. Occasionally, an author who isn't coming to Los Angeles comes to my attention with a book that I like very much, and I decide that it's worth introducing his work on the show and will call Outside. Still Life with Insects came to my attention in the last year's collection of contemporary American fiction. It was a very beautiful and odd, a kind of mysterious story told through a diary that an old man, Elwin Farmer, keeps of beetles that he's collected in the field in the course of his job as grain inspector. The book is a story about a grandfather, a man who begins at 43 when the novel opens. The book takes him into his 80s, and it's told with a very beautiful, mysterious kind of tenderness. I have the author, Brian Keitley, with me on the phone. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
It was a pleasure to discover this book. Can you tell me a little bit about how it came to be written?
Well, about 6 years ago, I think 7 years maybe, I was visiting my grandfather, and I had never noticed his locality notebooks before, and grandchildren always slept in the basement of his house, and I slept next to his table where he did a lot of the mounting of insects. He was an entomologist, and I saw this locality notebook and wrote down a few notes from it in my own journal, not thinking much about it, and I didn't think about much about it for a couple of maybe 6 or 8 months, and then was looking around for something to work on, because I was in a workshop in a graduate program, and it started from there.
You know, the book has, as its epigraph, a quote from Thoreau: "The world is nevertheless beautiful, though viewed through a chink or knothole." And what I thought about the book was that it was an imaginative exercise in finding the place where, in a person who might be restricted or in many ways controlling or constricted, to find that chink or that knothole through which life is beautiful for them. You know, finding the beauty in a life that may not be necessarily the one that a person would choose. Is there something of that in the book for you?
I suppose so, but what most appealed to me initially, and in the long run, writing it, was to write about someone I liked so much. He was a grandfather who I only saw a month or so every year, but we were very close to him, and he was just a very appealing character in my life, in my childhood especially, and yet someone I didn't know very well, certainly about periods of his life beyond my own life. And the exercise for me, and it was definitely an exercise at first, was simply to try and imagine beyond, which isn't a very imaginative exercise, but seems to have yielded something. I think what I was trying to convey was the love he felt, and or the love I felt for him, without becoming mawkish or overly emotional about it.
Well, there is the feeling in the book throughout that the precise naturalistic descriptions are at one and the same time a form of restricted emotion and yet they provide a, what would you say, a small conduit, an inlet for beauty, uncharacteristic beauty, to be discovered and expressed in perhaps unforeseen circumstances. And I thought, in many ways, the beauty of the novel for me was, on the one hand, it's formality. It's a grave book. And yet, at the same time, there's a kind of unexpected loveliness in it, that both in the writing and in the perceptions of the characters, that comes through very deeply. This grandfather of yours, how would you describe him outside the book?
A funny man, a man with a wonderful wit, sharp, very dry wit, something of a terrible tease as well. Mostly the humor, I think, is what was most notable about him. I think also, I suppose as a child growing up, the thing that was remarkable, and this is something I didn't really know as a child, but he was a very relaxed and happy man by the time he'd retired, or by his late 50s and early 60s, when he'd begun to take up entomology again. He took it up having started it as a young man in graduate school and been forced to drop out of graduate school much later in life, and this was also one of the impulses of the novel, to study someone who grew from a period of relative ill health in his 30s and 40s, from overwork and from his own personal way of dealing with the world, which was perhaps repressed and overly reserved, to come to some sort of grips with life, enjoyment of it, and the book is, I suppose, a simple charting of the travel from ill health to health, mental health.
You know, I was talking earlier with Cynthia Carohata, whose book features a kind of rapacious and impatient grandmother. And this book is, of course, dominated by the spirit of the grandfather. Proust is himself very given to acknowledging ancestral presiding spirits. And yet I would think that grandparents are as unfamiliar in current American fiction as they often are to their grandchildren. Are there grandparents in fiction that you've, what would you say, stumbled across?
Well, aside from Proust's grandmother, the lovely characterization, I can't think of any offhand. Some of my favorite writers are more family-oriented, but no, I can't think. I certainly didn't have any models of this type of relationship.
Who were among those favorite family-oriented novelists?
Well, one who's come since I've finished the novel, so he's not really an influence on it, but Bruno Schultz is one of the great...
Oh, absolutely.
The great
yes.
Characters in my life, and I use that word purposely, the figure of Bruno Schultz himself, as well as his father, and the loving, crazy portrait, a very much less neurotic, but still somewhat mad version of Kafka's family, I think.
If you get the opportunity, there's a book by a Los Angeles writer, Bernard Cooper, a book of prose poems called Maps to Anywhere, that will be coming out soon, that has an American Bruno Schultz family of such incandescent texture and prose that I recommend it particularly to you very highly. If you were trying to talk about Donald Barthelme, whom you told me in an earlier conversation had been an encourager on this particular novel, and whose loss we all feel very deeply, how would you describe him?
As a particular encouragement for the novel, it was interesting. I mean, I took him in a workshop and then started this novel on a workshop with him, And I don't know that you said you saw perhaps a bit of his influence. I don't know that I do, but it also struck me in his classes that he tended to be much harsher, much tougher on the people who were imitating him, who were writing in his style, and was more genuinely interested in different approaches to fiction.
Oh, when I said his influence there, I meant not that you sounded like him, but that over the years I'd noticed that Donald encouraged people to start scenes from peculiar angles. He had an ear for sentences that was unbelievable. He could take out a single word and a sentence would leap to a realigned life that couldn't have been anticipated.
That might be that's a very good point, actually. I do think his dialogue, his ear for spoken conversation was extraordinary, and perhaps he saw and encouraged that in me. I think at times, at least, I don't know that my novel is entirely successful this way, but I think there is a strong local dialect. I'm not quite sure which, but the Midwestern Canadian,
yes,
dialect. And I think I do have that at times, which is a surprise to me because I've never really lived there, and I don't know, aside from my grandparents, whose dialect I'm sure has been somewhat, over the years, was repressed, but something came out, something came through.
Still Life with Insects, which has been published by Tickner and Fields, has been getting very positive reviews, and I wanted particularly to bring it to the attention of readers in Los Angeles because it is a book that might somehow fall between the cracks. It's a much more fragile, odd book than one might find. In fact, you know, the interlude music, which is by Satie, reminded me a bit of this novel because Satie writes music that you think is music for insects to move their antennae to. I wanted to thank you, Brian Keightley, for being with me today, author of Still Life with Insects.
Thank you. We talked
earlier to Cynthia Kadohata, author of The Floating World. This is Michael Silverblatt. I want to thank Bob Carlson, the engineer, Melinda Siegel, the associate producer, and we will be back with you next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bus.
You're listening to KCRW, Santa Monica, a community service of Santa Monica College at 89.9 FM, National Public Radio for most of Southern California.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.